It is November the 27th, 1978, and this is an interview with Lieutenant General Lane by R.H. Roy.
I think I should perhaps explain our relationship with the Germans, because it was rather an interesting one at the time. I'm now talking sort of semi-political and on a military basis, because at that time the Luftwaffe had just been re-equipped with 104s. And they were having a terrible time with two things, maintenance and accidents. And their accident rate was something unbelievable. At one stage, the U.S. Navy apparently had some, too, and at one time, their airplanes were not even allowed to fly over water, much less anything else. It was, and that was an order from their government, from the federal government. It came up on the floor of the House, and because of the accident rate, there was a debate on the 104s, and it came down as an order right from the House that they would not fly over water because they had lost a couple of airplanes over the water, and they were concerned about the emergency gear that was on board, etc., etc., etc. Well, the commander-in-chief of the Luftwaffe at that time was General Steinhoff, who had been a very famous World War I pilot. And then in the immediate post-war era, when the Luftwaffe got going again, he was one of the first people to fly their post-war jets, and he had a very bad accident, in which he was severely burned, particularly around the face, to the point where he had no eyelids. And it was most interesting. It took a little while to get used to him, as a matter of fact, because he would never blink, of course, because he had no eyelids. And severely burned. His face was very badly scarred, notwithstanding a lot of skin transplants and a lot of work. And just to show how sensitive he was, I guess it'd probably be about the first time I met him. It was at our ambassador, our ambassador's residence in Bonn, just outside Bonn. He had a dinner and invited my wife and myself. We went, and Steinhoff was sitting directly across the table from me, I suppose purposely, so we could chat. And they brought ice water, and there was lots of ice in the glasses. And without thinking, Steinhoff picked up this glass of ice water and almost dropped it. And he spilled it, of course, and they had to clean it up. He then apologized because his hands, which were also very badly burned, were so sensitive to heat that he never knew whether it was cold or whether it was hot. And the ice, when he picked up that ice water, it was so cold that he reacted as if it was hot, and he literally almost dropped it. So he was very, very sensitive to heat, and he'd had a very, very bad accident. I was delighted to read much later, many, many years later, in fact, quite recently, where he had gone to the RAF Bern Hospital in the UK, and had eyelids transplanted. Now, I understand it was a very successful operation, but I haven't seen him since, and so I don't know. Anyway, yeah. A very interesting man. Well, as a result of that and our discussions that night, it was probably about the next day when I was then at Metz, when I got a phone call from him. And he said, refer further to our conversation last night and the great difficulties that we're having with our 104s, would you be agreeable for me to send down a team, a technical team, so that we could go over what you are doing and the differences in the airplanes and what modification programs you have introduced into the 104 to improve the flight safety aspects? And I said, by all means, General, just let me know how many, and I'll arrange it, and let's try and set a date. Well, we set a date, and then, to cut a long story short, a team came down, and they were with us not only at the headquarters, but at the wings, for I suppose close to a couple of weeks, and they went over all of our modification programs, everything that we had done to update the airplane. We had made one major change in the 104. We had changed the ejection seat. The original ejection seat was a U.S. design, and it was not very good, and we put the Martin Baker ejection seat, which is more of a British design, into the 104, and it was much more effective, primarily because you could eject on the ground, and and you would get up high enough that your chute would deploy, and you'd be saved. In other words, you could walk away from it. I had occasion to actually see that work again a little later at LAR, when I was in the CO's office, and his office overlooked that is the wing CO's office, and it overlooked the airfield, and the 104s were taking off and landing, and all of a sudden I was just looking out the window. I had just walked up to the window and was looking out. And this 104 came trundling down, and the 104 makes so damn much noise that you stop talking when a 104 takes off. And I stopped talking because you couldn't, the noise level in the office was so high that you couldn't carry on a conversation. And then as I was watching this 104, and he was just getting ready to rotate, he was just sort of getting ready to lift off, when there was an enormous explosion. And the bloody airplane started to come apart. And out of this mass came the seat, and the parachute deployed, and the airplane was breaking up, and of course the tanks let go, and the whole thing caught on fire, and it was skidding down the runway, and there was jet fuel all over the runway, and the whole thing was on fire, and this lad in his parachute came down right in the middle of the fire on the runway. The main airplane, of course, continued on and had gone off the end of the runway. Unfortunately, he wasn't injured in any way. He just hit his automatic release on his parachute and ran like hell and got through to the grass on the side of the runway and wasn't burned in any way. He was very lucky. But I relate the story. It was the one and only time I have actually seen a seat ejection work on the ground. And he walked away with it. He was a pretty badly shaken lad. What had happened was that airplane had just gone through an inspection, and he was the wing test pilot. And every time we had a policy that whenever an airplane had been through a major either an inspection or a major an engine change or some major maintenance, that the test pilot was the one who would test that airplane. And of course, always a very highly qualified man who knew the airplane backwards, much more so than the average fighter, the average combat pilot would. And it was because he knew the airplane so well and knew what to do, and he reacted instinctively. He knew what had happened to the airplane, there was an ingestion of some kind, and we never were sure what it was, into the engine. And, of course, all the blades exploded, and it must have been something pretty big. Whether it was a bird or what, we don't know. But literally, the whole engine just blew up. And as it blew up, it was such a big explosion that it took the whole airplane with it. And fortunately, nothing hit him. It was behind him, of course, the engine, and he just instinctively just hit the panic button and popped out of the airplane. And thank God he did, because he lived to tell us what he thought had happened, and we were able to then carry on an investigation. But it was that... Now, if we had had the original seat, he would have been killed. He would absolutely have been killed. No one would have possibly gotten away from that airplane except by the Martin Baker seat. Well, it was that kind of thing that was happening in the German Air Force. And they were losing a lot of pilots as well as airplanes, whereas we may have been losing airplanes because of loss of engine in a single-engine airplane. And if you lost your engine, there was nothing to do but get out. And sometimes this happened on takeoff or at fairly low altitudes, whereas we would lose the airplane. We wouldn't lose the pilot. And the Germans were losing both. That was just one of many things we had done to improve the flight safety of the airplane. Well, the team went back, and he was absolutely delighted. And as a result of course, had been having received orders from the German Bundestag, he then immediately went back with a program, a fairly large financial program, and got immediate authority to carry out pretty well all the modification programs which we had done. And it took time, but we of course now had more than a vested interest in what was happening in the Luftwaffe, and we kept tab on all of their figures, and you could see their accident rate, and particularly their fatal accident rate, just nosediving down on the graph, and it was just great. And it was delightful. The German Air Force annually has a big ball in Beethoven Hall in Bonn, and it's called the Luftwaffe Ball, done up to the teens. A magnificent affair. They bring in their operatic stars and their ballet stars, as well as various types of orchestras. Beethoven Hall must have 6 various concert rooms in it, and they have an orchestra in each one. There are about 1,200 to 1,500 people go to this ball, and it's all very, very formal. And one One part of the evening, of course, is the chief getting up to welcome everybody and speak for just two or three minutes. And that first year, after all that had been going on, he introduced me, which I caught me completely off base, introduced me as the commander of the air division, and referred to me as the new father of the German Air Force, which was rather nice of him. But in front of some 1,200, 1,500 Germans, it came as a bit of a surprise, I can tell you. But I knew what he was getting at. He was so pleased with the way things had gone and the assistance we had given him, which actually was not very great. Hell, we probably would have done for anybody else, but they particularly needed help. And then the other problem they had was on their maintenance. They were, of course, still in the middle of conscription. And the net result was that their technicians were running through a very course and then going on to an airplane to work without really the experience nor the background that were required, and they didn't have enough senior NCOs for proper supervision. So we helped them there. We did it by giving them our training manuals, how we went about doing the maintenance on our airplanes. About that time, we were getting into what was known as card indexing maintenance. I won't explain it, but instead of a lad going out and just simply doing everything, he would have a little card, and he would have to tick off on everything. Then the NCO would come along, would very rapidly check everything he had done, and then would countersign everything. So that you had a check on a check, so to speak. And that, again, worked wonders. The system was such that no two people were on the same part of the airplane at the same time, so they weren't getting up in each other's way. It was a time phase type of program, and it worked beautifully. It saved hours. It cut down an inspection on airplanes. The best example was on the Yukon, where it used to take us about 10 days to do a full blown inspection on the Yukon in transport command using the same system. We finally got it down to where it was taking about 3.5-4 days. And with fewer people too. Seriously, enough, fewer people. It's management. It's a form of maintenance management, but good maintenance management.
Did we do this ourselves?
We developed this pretty well in house. There had been the United States and Great Britain. Some management people had talked about doing this, but we grabbed hold of it and ran with it, and we even improved on the system as a result of time. And thank God we did. Because we were, all the time I'm talking about in this period, we were under great pressure to reduce our manpower. And, of course, the bulk of our manpower was in our maintenance organizations. And, therefore, any way we could save man hours in our maintenance organization helped when it came to the crunch, you've got to cough up another 10% of your people. Well, by improving the output per man hour, we were able to accept some of these cuts without directly affecting our operational capability. And thank God. Part of it, maybe why we were so good at it, was because we were forced to be good at it, because we knew that we had to do this to keep ahead of the personnel chops. And we're now talking about the time period when the armed forces started to go down from that sort of 120,000 down to their current 79,000.
Well, can I shoot another question at you, Reg? Under normal circumstances, how many men are there behind each pilot in the plane?
It depends entirely on the airplane. Let me see if I can remember. On the Yukon, oh gosh, on the Yukons, I suppose we would run about 30 or 40 people behind each one. You take all, not only do you got your main servicing or your heavy inspection, which I've just been referring to, but you've got minor inspections, you have unserviceabilities, and you have straight daily servicing of an airplane. Each, that all takes manpower, and your organization is such that your men are fully employed. And again, this is where this sort of card system comes out. In the 8-hour day, you got 8 hours work out of every man. On the 104s, I can't remember what the figure would be. It wouldn't be quite that big, but I would guess it would be at least 20 to 25 men behind each airplane. But this maintenance system also, of course, was what the Germans were looking for, because while they had some experienced NCOs, their experience was so diluted that they had to have a system where the NCO was doing the checking, not the work. And the card system, or that kind of maintenance system, was really made for them. Because they were then able to have their relatively inexperienced people, like an assembly line. They would do one or two things. And then, of course, they soon got to the point where they did it well. Mm-hmm. And then the NCO would be able to check. Manpower was not their problem, I might add. The Germans never had any trouble with manpower, nor with money. And I'll come to that in a minute. So that what they needed was a quick fix. And we were able to help them in that on the maintenance side as well. So they were extremely grateful for what the assistance we were giving them. And as a result, the relationship between myself and Steinhoff went on right up until much later, when he became chief of the German forces, and then went on and became chairman of the NATO Council, the military committee of NATO, and retired from that position. And every time there was any kind of a meeting at Shape, or if there was something in the way of an exercise where he would be there, always we had dinner together or something like that. And it was he was a fine person, a very fine man.
Ex-Luftwaffe.
Yes, he was a fighter pilot during World War II. Well, and it helped us too. The air division's main training area for bombing and for any firing of any guns and that sort of thing now was down in Sardinia, Decimomannu, which was a base shared 50% Italian, 25% Canadian, and 25% German. This was all the infrastructure was shared that way. Germans had the most magnificent test equipment that you could believe. They had more test equipment down in on a small training unit than we would have in a whole squadron in one of our wings. And the terrible thing about it was that they didn't have people who knew how to operate this stuff. Well, what we did, of course, was we whipped all of our stuff. We were always short of test equipment, specialized maintenance equipment, always short in the air division because of the scaling that had been done in the initial procurement was done, pared right back to the bone, pared back too much. So we whipped everything back from Deci and just used the German stuff. We not only helped them, showed them how to operate the stuff, but we used their stuff as well. And that meant that we could bring some of our own stuff back and put it in the wings where it was needed operationally. And it was good. But the Germans were delighted, quite happy to share their the use of their stuff, again, because we had helped them help them operate it and made sure that they were using it properly. So, that, again, there was a sort of a relationship. And from there on, as I say, our association with the German Air Force and with Bonn was first class. With the Italians and Decimomannu, not quite. Decimomannu. Deci, Deci, Decimomannu. Decimomannu. And it's a small village down on the southern part of Sardinia, not too far away from Cagliari. As a matter of fact, you could drive into Cagliari, and I think it was about half an hour. But it was a NATO base. Built out of, plowed out, dug out of nowhere. And I used to like to go down there because, of course, it was in the Med, and it was very, very pleasant. So Sardinia is very pleasant, very rugged, mind you. Cagliari was no Paris, nor was it a Rome, but it was still not bad. But the Italians ran the base. They pocketed 50% of the cost, and at least they didn't pocket. The agreement was that they paid 50% of the cost of operating the base. But they manned it. Well, annually, there was a planning conference at which we decided what the cost of the base was going to be, and then it was divided up 50%, 25%, 25%. Germans never cared very much about that conference. They'd send one person to sit in and so forth. And I began to get very, very suspicious of the figures that the Italians were quoting, because I really suspected that they were dinging us. Prices, they were quoting things for maintenance which weren't showing up anywhere. So I put a colonel onto it, the next, that year, and I said to this colonel, I said, all right, you, I want you to get a team together, and I want you to go over this whole bloody thing with a fine-tooth comb. And I want to have preliminary meetings to discuss all of the costing, and even a review of the establishment. Now, the Italians maintain they've got X number of people and civilians working on that base, for which we're paying part of their salary, and I don't think they've got them there. Well, again, to cut a long story short, it took us a year, and the Italians were irate. The only way to describe it, they were furious with us. And we just refused to sign anything until we had seen the substantiating figures. And I mean everything. Manpower, establishments, the Bowsers, the equipment on the airfield that supposedly was we would have to pay for, a part of it, every vehicle, the radio equipment, everything. We went through the base with a fine-tooth comb. And as a result, we saved, in the first year, we saved the Canadian government $1 million. Because the Italians were not producing what they said they were. And again, the Germans just sat back and thought this was magnificent because, of course, they also saved the same amount of money, although we did all the damn work. And I even went so far as to go and see the Italian chief of the air staff. And I told him quite bluntly that we were not going to sign the agreement until we were satisfied that we were being charged correctly. And he kind of smiled a wee bit, I don't know whether, and said, all right, well, and a very fine relationship. I have in one of my photo albums a picture, and somebody put a caption underneath it, and it implying that I was the mafia, because of the look that was on my face as I was going after the Italian chief. But the agreement from there on, every annual meeting for the agreement was the annual share cost sharing in Italy was good, and we were quite happy. We kept it from there on. We set up a procedure really for an annual review, which worked. And from there on, I was satisfied that we weren't being dinged. Yeah. I used to enjoy it because it meant that for the final signing and the final agreement, it meant I had to go to Rome. And I would, it meant staying probably 2 days in Rome. And I used to always work it that we would go down on a weekend, so we'd have an extra day just to enjoy Rome. And I think Rome is just a beautiful, incredible city. And I used to look forward to the annual meeting on the Decimano Agreement, because it was such an enjoyable time.
I suppose on these trips, you know, whether you think in terms of Sardinia or Rome or Bonn or what have you, for the most part, you would fly there.
Oh, yes, because we had a Dakota in the air division at that time that was called the AOC's, the commander's airplane. Yeah. And it was used for that kind of thing. If I had to go up to a meeting in Bonn, or if I had to go to a meeting at 4th ATAF, or at up at Shape, then that airplane was available. And if I was suddenly called back to Ottawa for a meeting, I would use that airplane to get to either whichever airport I had to go to get the first airplane out. For example, sometimes I had to go to Paris to get the first flight. Other times it would be Frankfurt. It all depended on what the schedule was and how panicky it was for me to get back. So, and the airplane also, of course, was used to move people back and forth to Decimano, for the rotation of crews and the rotation of the ground crew, because we never, with the exception of about three or four people, we used to rotate the ground crew at Decimano. We only kept a very small permanent staff down there of about half a dozen people. And they lived literally in sort of PMQs or on the economy in this small village. Mm-hmm. So we used to rotate the people, and this aircraft was used to help rotate the people as well. Well, The Italian relationship was it started off pretty heavy, but it wound up being very, very good. Then, of course, I suppose in this whole field of politics, we come to our national situation, and that perhaps is not quite as happy a story. There are the two parts I think I really want to talk about, or perhaps three parts. One, of course, is unification, because unification began to really hit about this time. And I'm now talking about when I went over, which was 66, 67, 68. That was the time I was in the air division. And by that time, policies were really coming into effect.
Yeah,
then, yes, that's right. Yeah, the main policy had been determined in, what, 64, I guess it was, when the act was passed in the House, but it took a long time for it all to be translated into hard policy. Then there was the question of Pearson, who had started the reduction in the forces, but it was really Trudeau who then came in and continued with a very heavy axe to chop the armed forces. And the other aspect, of course, was our weaponry and nuclear weapons, and that was what I was very bitter about, the whole nuclear weapons setup. Well, unification. Unification in the air division really wasn't too much of a problem because we were still strictly an airman. It was a nuclear role. No one else had anything to contribute to a very good extent. And it didn't really hit home. We began to get instructions about wearing the green uniform. So, of course, that started and got the first. I was the first one to wear a green uniform in the air division.
Well, before you get on to that, Reg, just a little bit, what would you say was the feeling among the airmen about unification?
Oh, very anti. Terribly anti, just as it was in the Navy.
Yeah.
Very, very anti. Very anti. I think it was an anti-feeling, but I think the airmen sort of felt that, well, so what? It really isn't going to affect us too much. I don't think people got too uptight about wearing the green uniform. We didn't get up. Certainly, the airmen didn't get uptight about the change in ranks, because the senior airmen always had known for years that we had annually discussed the advisability of swinging over to the USAF ranks, because we by now were dealing far, far more with the USAF than we were with the RAF. And therefore, with all of the meetings that were going on all over the United States, in training schools, in the various commands, and of course in Washington, it was always a bind. Air Vice Marshal always seemed to be an enormous mouthful for an American, and they never seemed to appreciate exactly what that meant in relative terms from a rank point of view. And we had discussed, I have to remember three separate occasions, well before unification, when we had discussed. And the chief, I guess there were two involved in this, had taken a very, had started by saying, all right, here we go again, I'm under pressure, it's on the agenda, I'm under pressure to that we change our ranks. But I am not going to do it unless there is unanimous consent of all of senior officers. Now, the senior officers meant all of the AOCs who were in the conference, plus all of the senior officers in Air Force headquarters. In other words, the Air Council. And it invariably happened that there would be one or two who would say, no, I do not agree. An emotional thing, very emotional, and historical and traditional. And they would say, no, I cannot agree. So it was never actually put through as policy. But it was only because of one or two people. Now, the rest all felt that the time had come to work more closely, much more closely with the USAF, because we were very much a small partner. And by this time, we were up to our eyeballs in NORAD and all the fighter defense program. The Navy was working very, very closely down on the coast. In other words, our relationship with the Americans and all of our logistics now were coming from the States. So our association with the States was very, very, very close. And when you went down to a factory or you dealt with a contractor, if you said Major General, it meant something to him. You said Air Vice Marshal. And he didn't know who the hell you were. And so it was important in that sense. It was terribly important. Well, so the rank didn't bother the airmen. There were some of the, I suppose, at the colonel level, the group captain level, who perhaps were not as aware of what had been going on over these many years, as certainly I was, who took umbrage. And there were a lot who felt that a wing commander was a wing commander, even though he was a squadron commander. But that's nothing, you know. There were these idiosyncrasies, yeah, or these inequities, or whatever you want to say. A squadron leader was a flight commander, and a flight lieutenant was a deputy flight commander. The squadron leader was a flight commander, and a wing commander was a squadron commander, and so on it went. See, and a group captain was a base commander. He wasn't a group commander at all. So the thing was out of balance in terms of the names, which were a throwback to pre-war days. and had never changed, because during the war we swung over to where Squadley was a flight commander and the wing commander was the squadron commander. So it was a bit silly in that respect. But those were all the kind of arguments that had been discussed when we were talking about changing our rank in addition to the relationship with the Americans. Where I think the impact of unification was purely in emotion. And in one or two of the policies that came out, I'm trying to think of one or two, there were different retirement ages. And the Air Force had their own retirement ages, and the Army had theirs. Now, they were obviously all going to be put on the same net.
Right.
There was some concern about that, because the Air Force had always kept their retirement ages down low for a very good reason. That the Air Force is a young man's business. And you need to have at the top people with relatively recent operational experience to be in the position of making decisions. And you didn't want somebody who was 65, who probably had not been doing anything really operational, perhaps for as long as 20 years, and it just wouldn't fit. So we always insisted that... Oh, and also it helped to turn over people. If a lad was not going to go up the ladder, then he was retired at a young enough age that he could then go off and start a second career, if he felt so inclined. He would go up with a pension, but it would be a relatively small pension. Nevertheless, there would be an income, and he could supplement that pension by starting a second career if he wished to do so. In the meantime, you kept the younger people up in that damn cockpit, which was the important thing. When you start flying these modern-day airplanes, you've got to have fast reaction, or you've got to supplement it with a lot of experience, and after a while, even the more senior people were beginning to spend more and more time on staff jobs, which meant that they were getting farther and farther away from the cockpit, and when they did go back, it took them a long time to get back up to speed again. They'd just forgotten just how their reactions, or no, I'm sorry, they'd forgotten, they hadn't realized how their reactions had slowed down in those 10 years. And that, I only quote that as one, but there were undoubtedly other ones which tend to upset people. So that the overall reaction to unification initially was a very bitter one. It wasn't necessary. Why the hell did we have to do it? Emotional. Mm. And then it came about, well, all right, so what? How is it going to really affect us? What can happen? A pilot is a pilot is a pilot. A ground crew man maintaining an airplane is, there's no one else can do it. An aero engine mechanic is an aero engine mechanic. An airframe mechanic is an airframe mechanic. You don't take a vehicle mechanic and put him onto an airplane engine. So we kind of felt that we were a lot unto ourselves, if you will, and unification was all right from an administrative point of view. I don't think we ever had any real complaints about the administrative side in the sense that it would be a logistics that would be all brought together. We didn't have any strong feelings on the logistics side. If it meant that the furniture was all going to be bought in one big order, it was going to cost less, good. If it meant that the knives and plates we were using in the messes were all going to be bought together, fine. If it meant that all the gas we were using in our vehicles was going to be done on a major one big contract, fine. It just meant better prices. And that was readily accepted and readily understood. Same with blankets and all that sort of thing. The logistics side was readily... could be seen by everybody, by the troops, everyone, to see the value of the coordination of the logistics and the savings that could accrue from that. And no complaint there. And I think that's probably what made unification acceptable. It was the fact that it was the logistics side which was very positive. And whereas on the operational side, I don't suppose the Air Force was alone. The Navy felt the same way. Who the hell's going to go and drive a damn ship? He's got to be a Navy man. He can't be a pilot. The navigator on board ship might be a navigator, but people said, hell, that'll never happen. That's so far downstream that it'll never happen. Well, it did happen. And it's happening now. But very rare.
Yeah.
Just very exceptional. But it hit home to me, the impact, when I received word that there was a Commander Oxholm was coming over to the Air Division. And he was a Navy pilot and had trained on he had been on the Bonaventure and was a jet pilot in the Navy. And he was coming over to be a squadron commander, a 104 squadron commander. Well, I hit the roof. I burned the phone up for a week. flatly refusing, and I mean flatly refusing to accept this man. I went to the chief, I went to everybody, and said, no bloody way am I having a Navy man in the Air Division. One of my arguments was that a squadron commander in the Air Force, to become a squadron, we had so few squadrons in the Air Force. And it was the prime operational job. And I had squadron leaders by the hundreds who were just dying to have a crack at being a squadron commander. And if I accepted a Navy man, it meant that there was some airman who was not going to have that opportunity to be a squadron commander. That, amongst many other things. Well, it wasn't very long before I received a phone call, and I was told that I was receiving a direct order to accept one Commander Oxholm, and that was the end of it, period. And if I was going to object anymore, I might find myself on an airplane going back to Canada. So I thought, all right, well, and goddammit, having lost that battle, we'll go the next route. And I said at this particular phone call, fine, but I give you notice now that if he doesn't hack it, he's going to be also on the next goddamn airplane going back home. And it was left that way. Oxholm arrived, and lo and behold, if Oxholm didn't walk into my office in a green uniform, and which kind of shattered me a wee bit, because there weren't that many around, but Oxholm had made sure he was going to turn up in a green uniform. And I don't suppose Benny Oxholm said more than 5 minutes in that initial interview, which probably went on for the better part of 45 minutes. I did all the talking. I told Oxholm that I had not wanted him in the Bloody Air Division, that I had been ordered to accept him, that being the case, it was now a question of whether he would fit in or not, and I then proceeded to explain to him how, when we did have a squadron commander that had come over from Canada, how we went through the procedure of the senior flight commander in that squadron, really running the squadron for about the first 6 months, to make sure that the squadron commander was getting up to speed in the environment in Europe, since he hadn't had that experience before, as well as getting to know his squadron and everything like that. In other words, learning his trade in Europe, getting onto nuclear weapons, because most of our squadrons were strike squadrons, which was in itself was a big job, before he really took command, if you will. And it wasn't so much a question of taking command as it was that we felt that he was operationally ready to take command. Now, I'm talking purely operations, not the administrative side. The administrative side, he ran the squadron in that sense. He was a squadron commander. He was a CO. And then discipline and admin was his responsibility. But operations was a different story. Well, after all that, Oxholm, I said, you go out to the squadron and you keep your mouth shut. You learn quickly. And you come and tell me when you think you are ready to take over the squadron. And with that, he said, yes, sir, and saluted very smartly and left the office. Of course, in the meantime, he was going to a wing where the base commander, the CO, was not only a very highly qualified operational man himself, but he had a great ability of handling people. And I had been on to Bert and told Bert that he was receiving him, and Bert didn't like the idea. But again, because he had squadron leaders, he would like to have seen him taken this one. And I told Bert, after I'd seen Oxholm, I told him exactly what I'd said to him, and I said, I want you to let me know when you think he's ready as well. Watch him like a bloody hawk, because we don't want any nonsense, we don't want any foul-ups in the squadron. Well, time passed, and about 3 months later, Bert Allison phoned me, and he said, he's quite a guy, this Oxholm. He said, you know, he's ready. And I said, come on, Bert, get off it. You know, what the hell's he done, bought you some drinks or something? He said, no, I'm serious. He said, he is an extremely capable man. As a matter of fact, he said, he is a bloody airman. He's not a Navy man, he's an airman. He's terrific. And so I said, all right, okay, well, if you really think so, I told him to come in when he thought he was ready, so give him a little bit longer, and then if he comes to you, okay, shoot him up. Well, it was about a month later that I received a call, could Oxholm come and see me? Now it's about 4 months. And, of course, I checked with Bert again. And Bert said, no, Chris. He's not only good himself. We brought him through some of the checks and the various paper exams and all this, and God, he's been getting hundreds right across the board. He's superb. And he's also done what I thought would be the most difficult thing. He said he's got the whole squadron behind him. He's just gained the confidence not only of all the pilots, but also a lot of the ground crew as well. He's terrific. So with that, I had Oxholm in. And again, in a, probably from my great ivory tower, kind of down my nose a wee bit at him. Said, I understand that you feel you're ready. But I don't suppose I was very kind to him. But I let him go. As a squadron commander, he now had command, period. From there on in, it was all on his shoulders. Any foul-ups were his problem. Well, it went on, and then, of course, very soon after that, there was a contest, and none of his squadron didn't come out on top and this sort of thing. Well, I finally had to do the about-face and admit that I was wrong. And I had Oxholm in. He had done so well. I had him in to congratulate him, Benny, and apologize to him. And Benny Oxholm, he's still in the service, is a big man, and he laughed, and he said, I expected it as soon as I knew I was going to come to the Air Division. He said, what I never did tell you was that I was the one who bugged to get on the 104. I was the one who made such a nuisance of myself in Ottawa to get on 104s that they finally told me I was going to get a squadron just to get me off of bloody Ottawa. So it was that keenness, you know, and of course it showed all the way through. And he was he was an extremely capable squadron commander, and he's still a very capable officer in the service. Well, he was here.
Yeah,
he was here. That's right. Very short, not for very long, because he was being promoted, and I'm not surprised. And he's now back east. But Ben didn't let his, if I could put it this way, didn't let his Navy background in any way interfere with what he was doing or with the squadron, and he became accepted with the Air Division. When he left, he was a very, very popular squadron commander right throughout the whole of the Air Division, not just on his own wing, but he was known now right throughout the organization. A very capable and very fine person. Well, that kind of taught me a lesson. Here I had been very anti just because he was Navy, and it taught me the lesson that a Canadian is a Canadian is a Canadian. And it just didn't necessarily follow. Just because he hadn't been through our training program, that he wasn't any good. And he was a bloody good case in point. But he stacked up against all of our best squadron commanders. He was of that nature. And just because he had had Navy training, didn't mean that he wasn't any good at all. So unification in that sense, I learned a very important lesson, which was to come into play much later on, too. That it was a old business, that all three services had some extremely capable people in their organization. And it was a simple matter of giving them the opportunity to practice or train, if you will, in something which they had not been used to, and they would grasp it and grab it and run with it and do extremely well as a normal matter of course. And this is what happened later on. So that was one lesson I learned, and it certainly softened my attitude a bit about interchangeability. Where I had thought it would not work, it was obviously the head. Well, I don't suppose unification. I never personally, as a result of all that, I had all these things I'm talking about, like the rank business and the logistics and this one incident of this one man who came to the fore, and the fact that the services as such were fairly safe on the operational side. I never did really take a very strong anti-unification stand. I knew, having been to so many conferences in Ottawa, I knew the problem of the purse strings. I did know that we were in trouble. And manpower was the main overhead cost. And if we were going to reorganize and eliminate an awful lot of headquarters, obviously we were going to save manpower. We were going to eliminate a lot of depots, and we did. It wasn't very long. I think the first figure was something like 11 depots were eliminated. Or amalgamated. And the saving in manpower alone from the amalgamation of those 11 depots was enormous. So I could see the benefits of unification. I could see that the crunch was on financially and manpower-wise. And at that time, unification was just one way of meeting the challenge, if you will, or the direction that we were to reduce our manpower and yet still maintain an operational capability. So while I was not keen on it,
by a long shot. Like, no one was keen on him. They may have been one or two, but certainly I wasn't keen on him. I never took such a strong stand that I was willing to resign, as some of the people did. I never felt that strongly about it. I felt that perhaps the good things of it could be made to work. And it was a question then of trying to get the best out of everything and make the whole system good in that respect.
But you're talking more of integration rather than unification when you talk about the reduction of depots and all that sort of thing.
Well, by that time, of course, the headquarters had been unified, too. You had people who were, the various slots in headquarters were being divvied up amongst the three services. Mm-hmm. So that you had people who were handling and laying down policy for all three services, and that's unification. The rank structure had been all melded together, particularly at the senior level. Mm-hmm. The officers' list was coming out as an amalgamated list at the general level, because below that everyone had, but the support trades were being amalgamated, the supply people were all being brought together, the field engineers and our construction engineers and so forth. There was a lot of amalgamation going on down the line, and this is why it took so long to implement unification. Once the policy had been set, there was an enormous amount of work that had to be done further down to make the thing a viable operation and to bring it all together. Many hurdles. Oh, dear God. Conferences to resolve matters of policy at the lower level. And, oh, dear, trials and tribulations. And a lot of hard-nosed decisions having to be taken by the man up the totem pole, where the problem was insoluble. There was no way that the solution could be found. And therefore, someone had to say, this is what it's going to be. To the chagrin and heartburn of a lot of people. But it was hard-nosed. It was tough. Very tough. A lot of people developed bad reputations as a result of having to make some of those hard-nosed, because people felt they were traitors. It was terribly difficult. I personally, at that time, was not involved in any of that, because I was a commander in the field, and my particular command was one where this was not a major issue. It was to be a little later, but not at that time. So I kind of grew on the sides of unification. I was not directly involved with any of these nasty stuff that I knew was going on in headquarters, where these decisions were being made. So unification went on, and that was it, and it was policy, and once the act had been passed and it was going, and the various ministers were supporting it, and of course Trudeau was behind it, there was no point in fighting the damn thing any longer. It was a question of having to live with it and make the damn thing work if it was possible. And I used to advocate this when I got into some pretty hard-nosed discussions with some of my own people, and even some of the people who came over from Canada. I said, well, it is the law of the land. Now, let's try to make it work. And if, as you say, it is not going to work, then let's not let the government point the finger at us.